This is the Five Thick Podcast. For this episode, we read Edith Wharton's novel, The Custom of the Country, which was published in 1913. This is a novel about a girl from a town in the Midwest called Apex, who comes to New York City to do some major social climbing, and on her way up, she leaves a trail of destruction. We're going to start with Nina giving a summary of the book, but if you want to skip past, just go to about 7 or 8 minutes in.
The Custom of the Country is a novel by the American author Edith Wharton. The overarching story is the early adult life of the main character, Undine Sprague, over the course of about a decade through her relationships in her search for primacy in the high society world of 1880s New York City. The book is kind of architecturally split into 5 books. Book one provides a brief overview of Undine's upbringing in Apex, where her father was doing moderately well. But driven by a desire for social ascension and society living, Undine has uprooted her parents to embark on various itinerant wanderings around the country in search for better and better things. This is the main reason she's dragged her parents to New York City in the first place, which is where the story begins. And after a few false starts, she finally hooks and marries a man named Ralph Marvel, who is a member of what he terms the Aboriginal tribe of New York. This means he's descendant from prominent, you know, New York aristocracy figures, but this tribe is being slowly edged out by the, quote, invader species of new money and capitalism. Undine, still a relative newcomer, you know, doesn't realize that while Ralph and his family occupy high status and, you know, good reputation in New York, they don't actually have much money. And in fact, to finance her marriage, Mr. Sprague has to engage on a shady business deal with a man he knows from Apex named Elmer Moffat, whose presence in New York brings a lot of anxiety to the Sprague family since he was previously engaged to Undine. Book two relates the deterioration of Ralph and Undine's marriage, beginning right at the honeymoon in Europe. First, there's a clear personality difference. Ralph is an artist and a dreamer, while Undine is a materialist and a pragmatist. The second is economical. Undine is a flashy girl who loves being in the center of attention and having nice things, but Ralph's financial situation will never be able to support her lifestyle. It causes a lot of marital strife when Ralph requests that Undine slow her spending or limit her social engagements, so she slowly drifts away from him and towards another man, Peter Van Degens, who ironically is married to Ralph's old girlfriend, Claire. Ralph and Claire still kind of have feelings for each other, but are, you know, stoically living with Claire's unfortunate decision. Peter is kind of a like Casanova type. You know, he goes out, he lives large, and, you know, cavorts with women of varying levels of respectability. He has the cash to resolve all of Undine's money problems, and sometimes she can't resist taking him up on the offer, even though she knows it's not proper. A few years later, in a chat with Elmer, Undine gets the idea in her head that she can get a divorce from Ralph and marry Peter instead, based on the experience of some girls she had met from her previous wanderings, who she thought were below her, but now have sort of like leapfrogged her in situation. She works on making this happen when she and Peter both vacation in France. And also in this book, she gives birth to her son, Paul, but due to the lack of, you know, maternal instinct in Undine, he is basically left to the care of the Marvel family. And so book three relates to the disastrous outcome of Undine's plan. She gets her divorce, but Peter essentially ghosts her on this plan and doesn't get his divorce, so she can't remarry to him. While divorce was legal and accepted in some parts of America, it wasn't necessarily accepted in New York social circles, like the ones Undine is a part of. So, you know, she tries to save face by going to Paris, but she's increasingly becoming a pariah and her social circle, you know, is like rapidly constricting. You know, she tries to reject society by living by herself on the Riviera, but this is even worse. And her attempts to rejoin society in New York are rejected. So she goes back to Paris, where she finally hits a stroke of luck, where she meets a relative of a man named Raymond de Chelles. I don't know. you can correct my French, Fabrice.
Raymond de Chelles. You don't pronounce the S at the end.
Oh, okay. Chelles. Okay. Who she previously flirted with in Paris in her bid for Peter. You know, she's taken by Raymond's suavity and his urbanity and the fact that he's a marquis. And against a lot of opposition on his side of the family, she's able to get him to marry her. So then book four is one of the best books, in my opinion, because it shows the effect of Undine's actions on Ralph. You know, it's really pretty much Ralph's point of view of book three. So post-divorce, he's just been sitting at home, you know, working his dreadful job, feeling like a failure and wondering what has become of his life. And, you know, even though they spent very little time together when they were actually married, it's still hard for him to forget her. The only bright light in his life is his son, Paul. But now after her marriage to Raymond, she's requesting the child be sent to live with her. You know, and whether or not this is intentional extortion is debatable, but Ralph tries to pay her off to keep Paul. To raise the money within the time frame specified, though, he has to make a speculative investment with Elmer, who he trusts because he had helped him and Mr. Sprague with deals before. You know, and at this point in the book, we find out that Elmer, like Ralph, was both once married to and now is divorced from Undine, which is a detail that the Spraggs omitted to tell Ralph before the wedding. This revelation solidifies once and for all Ralph's disillusionment of his marriage. And unfortunately, the speculation doesn't give him the return he needed in time, and in despair, he shoots himself. You know, it's so sad to find out that the return comes just a few months later and that all the money, which, you know, goes to Paul, now goes to Undine anyway. And lastly, book five relates Undine's marriage to Raymond. Almost immediately, it starts going south, just as her first marriage did. Undine is outraged that Raymond restricts her social movements as well as their spending. And again, she makes the mistake thinking that because Raymond is titled, there would be plenty of money to finance her material desires. But the same tactics she used on Ralph and the Marvel family to avoid restrictions and assert her individuality doesn't work here in France. Raymond pretty much just ignores all her tantrums. So Undine is actually stuck being part of a family that she has nothing in common with in a large estate miles away from the active social scene. It kind of puts her in her place and she goes with the flow for a while. But then she gets the idea to finance her idealized life by selling some of the family heirlooms, in this case, tapestries. The appraiser brings a prospective client who turns out to be Elmer Moffat, who has become incredibly rich over the course of this whole book. After Raymond's fury at Undine's attempt to sell the tapestries, Undine runs to Elmer for comfort. Wharton uses this point in the book to relate the actual details of Undine and Elmer's past, which up to now has only been alluded to and inferred. She shows how they are quite similar in a way and feed off of each other's energy. Elmer, who has always loved Undine but respected her ambitions, proposes again to marry her. Then, the final chapter I think should probably be its own book, but since it's the only glimpse we see of Undine and Elmer married, as well as the fact that it's from the point of view of Paul, who is the unfortunate, you know, unlucky pawn in this whole saga. His parents are getting ready to host a dinner party in their giant new house in Paris, where Paul, you know, is like not allowed to touch anything. The final lines of this book are the dialogue between Elmer and Undine, showing how well they complement and understand each other, but also that Undine, having achieved her goal of financial stability in accordance with her social aspirations, still finds something wanting, which is to be, right, like a diplomat's wife, but she can't do that because she's divorced now, so it's like her reputation. So a lot happens in this book, you know. I was really interested in reading it because it doesn't seem to get as much attention as some of her other novels, like The House of Mirth and The Age of Innocence. But after reading this one, I really felt like it like completes the set, you know, of these stories about the upper class, you know, New York, you know, 1880s or late 1800s society. There are obviously similarities with respect to the subject matter, but it comes at it from like a really different angle. And so unlike in The House of Mirth or The Age of Innocence, where the protagonists are people who are part of the establishment, the protagonist in this book is like an outsider, the type of person that, you know, the insiders initially try to avoid contact with, but eventually, you know, have to succumb and let them into their, you know, social circle.
Me personally, I love that book. I didn't know anything about Edith Wharton and didn't even know her name. So when you suggested it, I just said, yes, you know, why not? And I was really, really pleased by it. She writes beautifully. I mean, English is not my first language, but I think I'm able to perceive a good writer when I'm reading one. And she definitely writes beautifully. I laughed several times reading her book too. You know, it's something that struck me. She's very funny.
Yeah, she has lots of like subdued quips, you know, that if you read too fast, you might miss it, but it's, yeah, they're really great.
I have a lot of sentences, but that I have highlighted that I thought were very funny. I'm just going to read one that I thought was, yeah, made me laugh. It's, it's Undine who's thinking, and she's disappointed because she's at the opera for the first time. She finally got that box that her father hesitated to buy for her, and that was already unacceptable. But she finally gets it, and she gets the opera, and she realizes there that there's this whole world that she's not a part of, and that's really frustrating. And then Edith Wharton writes, but it's Undine who's thinking, what was the use of being beautiful and attracting attention if one were perpetually doomed to relapse again into the obscure mass of the uninvited? Just like that. That's beautiful. And there were a lot of little gems like that. So just for a purely aesthetical, point of view, it was a delight. And I really enjoyed the character of Undine. She is like a Balzac hero, you know. She's, in my opinion, very unlikable. And yet you want to know what's going to happen to her. And you kind of, get attached to her nevertheless.
I thought the book was written very well. Edith Wharton is beautifully written prose. As Fabrice said, there are some funny, comical quips here and there throughout the book. And she stands to be a feminist heroine. I could see that. One thing that I noticed, and I tried to relate this more to like a modern impression of what an Undine would be, and Fabrice and I had a conversation before we started today that if she were present in today's society, she would be a huge Instagram hero. She would relish in that. She would want that kind of attention, and for lack of a better term, I'm going to use the word starfucker. Sorry. But that's kind of what it is someone who attaches themselves to other people because they know it's going to propel them into the stratosphere when it comes to popularity, when it comes to status, when it comes to class. And I think maybe in a way, I almost kind of view this as a satire. And the reason why is we have someone who is from the country, from the outside, wants to join this class, wants to become part of it. And the different elements of Undine, we see in other characters too throughout history that they've always attached themselves to what is popular, what can bring them status and class, and that again propels their own esteem. But it's also esteem by their what they feel perception of others of them, meaning how am I looked at through other people? How am I looked at through the eyes of other people is how I see myself. And I find her character to be I love her and hate her at the same time. It'd be someone very interesting to follow through Instagram or through Twitter or what have you, just to see who she's hooking up with now and to see who she's seeing with now at the latest, the latest movie that's come out and just posting pictures about herself. And it's all to serve her.
Yeah, for sure. That's like when she was getting her portrait done, or was thinking about it. And Ralph's like, oh, if a smart portrait's what you want, and she's like, I want what the others want.
Yeah, I want what that's what she is about. She values things only by trying to guess how other people that she thinks are admired values them. And that's basically how she works. She's other directed. And I think that, the parallel between her and Paris Hilton is relevant. There is some Paris Hilton, something Paris Hilton-esque in her. She has this voracious appetite, and that makes her in a way admirable. She wants what she wants with a lot of energy and determination. And that's something to be admired. But at the same time, there's something very childish in her, and that makes her ridiculous.
We also have to remember, though, that Paris was born into that kind of life with her family, the Hilton family, whereas Dean comes from the outside, comes from the Apex City. I thought it mentioned Iowa, which I did extensive research, and I couldn't find Apex City, Iowa, or South Dakota.
There's Apex City. It's like Springfield in The Simpsons.
Okay.
Right? Like, yeah.
Could be anywhere, yeah.
Well, I think, it seems like it's vaguely Midwestern, but it's completely mysterious as to what state or what exactly it has in mind. I could imagine, I remember they were referring to streetcars and waterworks in Apex, So I'm just guessing it sounds like a city of the size of at least like St. Louis or Cincinnati or something. So my basic take on the book is I can't necessarily say that her behavior is not realistic. There was a thing on Twitter yesterday where, you know, it was gay Twitter, right? And it was basically like this weird meltdown of completely self-centered guy, like Twitter personality, I don't know. I mean, it was basically the most shallow, self-centered little fit I've ever seen a human being do in my life. And I immediately thought, like, this is exactly like Undine, right? Like, and I think that the novel kind of struggles with where the hell does this behavior come from, right? It kind of toys with the idea that, well, maybe it has something to do with the equality of the sexes. But I don't think it does. It's like a really kind of a deeper wellspring is leading to this sort of behavior, and I don't exactly know what it is.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if you, I thought that there were some hints of maybe like allusions to, you know, evolutionary biology or like developmental biology, because there were a few references in the book that were talking about, you know, Ralph wondering where Undine got all her motivation from, like based on her parents, you know, being quite, you know, not aggressive people, you know, and very, you know, mild mannered and, you know, just kind of going with the flow, or like totally being okay with like other people telling them what to do or governing their lives, you know, as you can see by Undine. But also because there was a lot of like reference to, you know, Undine aping people, like just imitating things all the time, right? And so she's kind of like, I don't know, I felt like there were a lot of references to her sort of just being like a little monkey who's like able to just really, you know, mimic things or just learn little tricks for a reward. You know, this sort of, it was like a little biological kind of reference, I thought.
Your question, Dan, made me think of two passages in the book where I think Warthen tries to maybe give an answer to your question. She talks about the pioneer blood running through Undine's vein. That's in our edition, Penguin's Classics. It's page 35. And then on page 143, Warthen writes that she was too sternly animated by her father's business instinct. So she has something from her family, that kind of, that business instinct, something that makes her, incidentally, quite similar to Elmer Moffat. They have sort of the same nature. That's why they get along well. They're the same. They have the same frame of mind.
Something that's elemental to the Midwestern origins and the mention of pioneer blood, as you did in the passage, is that impetus in, and not to be patriotic or anything, but the American work ethic that in the Midwestern, especially agrarian societies, where they have to work in order to achieve their goals, whereas Undine doesn't see it that way, I don't think. She has that same kind of ferocity in her blood, but she's thinking, I'm not going to work for this. I'm going to attach myself to people who have worked or who have come from families that worked generations in the past and blue blood as opposed to nouveau riche. I'm going to advance myself through the works of others.
Oh, she works. She works, honey.
I actually thought there is a lot of like, she has a lot of self-confidence though, right? Like self-reliance in that, like, you know, just because she's Undine, she will get what she wants. And I thought that was like a very like, like a huge driving force for her. And, but like what you said about, you know, like the work ethic or whatever, and that self-reliance, like sometimes I always think, like a little bit like Willa Cathery, where, you know, there are, you know, her stories are about like these like fierce women, right? Who are just like really sure that they can do, you know, like work the land and like make their, you know, fortune themselves, this kind of thing, right? That she kind of does channel a little bit of that. What Fabrice was saying about like her business acumen, I actually thought that, you know, this was really interesting because she really treats marriage just like a business like transaction, right? It's like, what can you do for me or what can I gain from this, right? And there's really no like love or sentiment, which is like what a lot of relationship books are about. But she just like, you know, is this in my benefit? And if it's not, I'm just going to cut loose and run, right? And it's really interesting because she doesn't like think that she's losing anything by not marrying for love. It's such an interesting perspective, right? Usually people would attribute, you know, like, not, you know, giving up marrying for love, you know, for some other thing, you know, and it's sort of like a bittersweet thing to do or, you know, sad thing to do. But in her case, you know, she was like totally fine with it.
That's absolutely true what you say. And I remember when Ralph is sort of coming to terms with reality, and he understands what kind of person Undine is, his wife is. There's this, and he's thinking, page 136. I noted the sentence because I thought it captured very well the essence of what Undine is. It was admiration, not love, that she wanted. She wanted to enjoy herself. And her conception of enjoyment was publicity, promiscuity. Any personal entanglement might mean bother. And bother was the thing she most abhorred. She doesn't want a real relationship. She wants to be free. She wants everything to be smooth. Marriage is just a way for her to climb. And she's not a cruel person. She doesn't like to inflict pain on others, but she doesn't care about them. And so, unfortunately for Ralph, he was one step, you know, in her ladder, but it's nothing personal. You know, it's just what needed to be done at that point. And I should not exaggerate and say that she's scheming all the time and she always wants to go to climb up. I think that when she marries Ralph, she doesn't know that she will soon be dissatisfied and want something else. She doesn't know herself very well. When she marries Elmer, I think that she thinks that it might be the one. But then we learn at the end of the novel, and we're not surprised at that point, that no, there's something else that just came up, that just appeared on her screen, and oop, she's done with Elmer. It's just a question of time now.
The question is, though, she's not so much devious, where she's very brazen and very transparent in what she wants. But she doesn't come straight out and say, no, I want better. But she's constantly reaching for something more than what she has. Yeah. She's not really devious, though. Not like in the evil sense.
She reminds me of, you remember the movie Wall Street?
Yes.
Gordon Gekko, that speech that he gives. Greed, ladies and gentlemen. Greed is good. Greed cuts through. Greed captures the essence of the American spirit. She's kind of like that.
I can see
she's
that.
She's a greedy, focused person. And
she's okay with evil.
And yeah, she's fine with it.
She's absolutely fine with how she is. There's no shame in her game.
But there's also this ridiculous side to her. You know, she's an ignorant. For her, books are, you know, decorative. She doesn't understand why people read them. She's also very immature. Sometimes she has these. We hear her think, and you can't believe that a person, an adult, can think like that. Like one that I noted, page 162. If only everyone would do as she wished, she would never be unreasonable. Like, what kind of adult says that? What kind of adult thinks like that? It's just unbelievable to be thinking like that at her age. So that makes her ridiculous. So she is funny in that way because we like to, I mean, that makes her ridiculous and we laugh at her. But at the same time, that immaturity creates a lot of pain around her. And then we no longer laugh. And I like in that book very much the way that Edith Wharton was able to have these two elements in her book sort of come and go. Sometimes we laugh and sometimes we're terrified and appalled. And Ralph's suicide, for example, is a very, very, very sad, dramatic moment. Mm-hmm. I thought that Wharton was able to do those two things at the same time very, very cleverly and with a lot of talent.
Yeah, I think her pacing is really good too, right? She'll have like a lot of action and a little bit of introspection here and there. You know, I think it's like absolutely a very well-balanced book. But, you know, like going back to, you know, your comments about like Undine's like, you know, immaturity, you know, her impetuosity, right? Like her just need for like instant gratification. I just wonder how much of it is also due to her lack of like negative reinforcement against these things, you know, because like all of her upbringing from her parents to the Marvels, right? She's kind of like allowed to do a lot of this. But then once the scene sets, the scene changes to like France, you know, actually it kind of gets like tamped down. or like actively like resisted against, right? And she actually now has to like think a little bit more about like what she's doing and, you know, how she's being perceived by others. True. And what like actions are acceptable, you know? You know, I just wonder if like the sequence of her marriages were shifted in a way, right? Like would outcomes have been a little bit different, or, you know, obviously like some might not have happened. But just because she had been so used to, you know, being able to, yeah, like assert her, you know, desires on top of everyone else's, you know, with no negative feedback, you know.
She's definitely, in a way, the creation of her parents. And her dad finally, in the end, begins behaving like a dad and says no to her when she has that necklace. And he tells her, "Who gave you that necklace?" And she says, "Well, not Ralph." and he tells her, "You're going to send it back." And we are made to understand by Wharton that that's the first time it happens. Undine was never said no, never heard no from her dad before that moment. She's like 26, 27 years old. It's a little bit late in the game for her. And in that sense, you're right. It's not her fault. She's, to a certain extent, a victim of her parents' inability to raise her properly. There's something else that I wanted to say. There's another explanation that's offered to us in the book, or presented to us in the book. And I think that it probably is the most important one. There's undeniably the one that you mentioned, Nina. The fact that her parents were so permissive with her. She's sort of a king child or a queen child. Everything that she wants, she gets.
Spoiled brat.
Until that necklace. Yeah, she's a spoiled brat. But at page, and that's a very important passage because it's the only place in the book where the title is mentioned, The Custom of the Country. It's when Charles Bowen, you know, Undine has forgotten the birthday of her son. It's just unbelievable. She's forgotten. Has she forgotten or she just decided? No, she's forgotten.
She's forgotten.
And then she decides, I'm just not going to go. Yeah, she remembers it, but it's a little bit late. Whatever. I think that's what happens.
It didn't
and
serve
her. I'm sorry?
It didn't serve her needs. It didn't.
Yeah. And at the time, she felt like doing something else. Right. So the Dagonet or the Marvel family are waiting for her. And eventually they understand that she's not going to be coming. And everybody starts to pile on Undine, how, you know, terrible a mom she is. And they're very polite. It's a very proper family, but we understand that they do not like her, neither as a mom nor as a wife. And then Charles Bowen, I don't know how to pronounce it, Bowen, sort of defends her. And he basically tells the others that it's not a surprise that Undine is the way she is. American women have been treated like children by their husband. They are kept in that state of infantility by their husband. And then their husband are basically reaping what they sowed. American women are kept away from important matters, important business. They're kept in a state of infancy, whereas and that's something that Edith Wharton explains in a book that she wrote. I don't know if book is the proper term, but she wrote that in 1919 after the First World War, French Ways and Their Meaning. And there's a chapter in there where she compares the American woman and the French woman. And she says exactly the same thing, like word for word. So Charles Bowen says something that Edith Wharton believed to be true.
Just as a side note, to explain something for the listener, this Charles Bowen character we keep talking about, he is a friend of Ralph's family, and that's why he's in a position here of talking to them to try to explain Undine's behavior. The passage is, it's Bowen saying, "It's normal for a man to work hard for a woman. What's abnormal is his not caring to tell her anything about it." And then Mrs. Fairford, Ralph's sister, I think, to tell Undine she'd be bored to death if he did. And Bowen responds, just so, she'd even feel aggrieved. But why? Because it's against the custom of the country, i.e. she's essentially been taught to not actually partake in practical activities. And there's a suggestion of somehow this, you know, perverts her desire. But I think that is what Bowen is getting at, that like in a different world where with a different custom, you would have the Undines of the world would just become business women, which is maybe right and maybe wrong. But I tend to think that I think it's wrong because we kind of have sex equality now and you see Undines everywhere, male and female. Bowen is suggesting that if you were to change the custom of the country, i.e. to involve women in practical matters in business, Undine would, you know, taking after her father, become a businesswoman, which, you know, is a fair point. There's probably some point to be made here that, you know, when people have natural desires and they get thwarted, then they take, they get expressed in unhealthy ways or something, right? I think that is kind of Bowen's point. And, you know, feel free to disagree if you think I'm misreading it. But you know, the thing is that I don't, if to the extent that is an accurate reading of Bowen's point, I think it's incorrect because I think as a matter of human nature, because I think that there are Undines around everywhere, both male and female, and it's not getting at something accurately in human nature.
Well, I'm not sure that that's what Wharton means. When, for example, I think that Bowen's point is that in America, women are always treated like children. In the sense that, what do we do with children? We protect them from reality. And my children, they're still very young. I protect them from reality. I pay their bills. I clean their clothes. You know, I make sure that nothing too harmful comes near them. And gradually, I'm gonna make that protection disappear. And hopefully by that time, they will have gotten strong enough and intelligent enough to be able to, you know, take care of themselves. That's the normal way to do things. But when they're young, we protect them from reality because they're not equipped to deal with it. And I think that what Wharton suggests here, and that's what she says in that book that I mentioned, French Ways and Their Meaning. I think that's the title. I'm not sure. I'm just going to read it again. Yeah, French Ways and Their Meaning, 1919. She says that she compares American women to a Montessori child. There she mentions Montessori. She says what happens in those Montessori schools? We're cocooning the children, and so we protect them from reality. We make them live in a bubble. We're doing them a great disservice because they will not be equipped to deal with reality. When reality hits, they're not going to be strong enough to deal with it, and equipped to deal with it elegantly or efficiently. I think that Bowen makes the same point. American women, yes, they're not kept inside the house like Roman wives were. They are allowed to see other women, but only that. And the other women that they see are like them. So they have these sorority clubs. Yes, they drink tea together, but they're not dealing with life. They're, you know, and even after, you know, men go after dinner, men go in a separate room with their cigars and they talk business, they talk about reality, whereas women are left to themselves and they gossip about God knows what. So I think that's Bowen's point. I'm not saying that he's right. Maybe he's wrong. And I there's something to what you said, Dan, that there's something in Undine that's just eternal. And we mentioned Paris Hilton. She's not just a historical peculiarity. There will always be Undines, maybe unfortunately. But I think that Bowen's point is a serious one for Wharton. I think that's the key, in her opinion, to her novel. And the fact that the custom of the country is the only time in the, it, that's the only time where we see the title in the book, is probably indicative of that.
I also thought that Bowen's argument, though, was that sort of that women were more treated as like objects for men, like to have purchased to show their wealth or their might or whatever, you know, like the trophy wife scenario. But in mm-hmm. return, right, they do expect to be like showered with things. And, you know, unfortunately, in Undine's case, right, she sort of married someone who wasn't able to give her that sort of return on like herself, you know, like forgiving herself to him.
Return on investment. That's yeah. the phrase that you're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just thought that was really interesting. But also, you know, like, so Bowen has this critique, right, of American society. He, but also I think him and also like Raymond, right, do talk about how the tradition in French society is different than in American ones. And, you know, how you're talking about how, you know, American women are very coddled, right, their whole life. And, you know, to some extent, like that, you know, coddling is never really released or anything. I mean, but I do think that, like, for example, all of her, you know, in-laws from Raymond's side, right, they, the women just also kind of are very secluded from the external affairs of society.
Yeah, but you don't feel that the same frivolity in them that you feel in Undine. Me, the passage that in that Bowen speech that I thought was kind of getting to the point that I was trying to get at is when he says, someone says, Undine doesn't seem to notice how hard he works, the he being Ralph. And Bowen replies, no, why should she? Why should she? Really, Charles? Why should she? When she knows nothing about it. And that's exactly like my children. They don't understand what work is. They want me to buy that thing at Target. I say, well, it's $57, Henry. Yeah, can I have it, please? They don't understand the value of money. They have, and I'm not blaming them for it. I mean, they're kids, you know, they don't, for them, money is something that my parents have and that they sometimes refuse to spend for me. That's what money is for them. And Undine is not far from the same mentality. That's how she deals with her dad. When daddy doesn't want to buy her what she wants, she pouts and she sulks. She has the same attitude with her her husbands. When they don't want to spend the money, she behaves like a spoiled brat, which she, to an extent, is. But Bowen excuses her there. So going back to that feminist reading of that book, I think that it's defendable in that sense. I've read a couple of articles that want to see in Undine someone admirable. I think that's mistaken. Yeah, she's not admirable.
It's more of a cautionary tale.
Yeah, it is. But there is a feminist reading that can be made of that book. And I think that Bowen gives it. To an extent, she's a victim. She's a victim. To an extent. A victim of the custom of the country. Yeah. That custom of the country did her in. And that's not her fault. That's the angle that I think maybe feminists should try to take on that book.
I do agree that she's a product of the system.
Why does she think the French have such a better custom in the country?
I don't think that one could say that French people are superior to Americans or Americans are superior to French. I'm far from thinking anything like that.
If you think that, you can say it. You can
no, but
say
I don't. But I'm not French. I'm not American. I'm Canadian, so okay. I'm impartial.
Oh, okay.
No, but I'm serious. What she says is that. French, and she mentions, I'm not talking about the upper crust. I'm talking about the average French people and the average American people. You know, average French woman, average American woman, which Undine at the beginning kind of was. She mentions the fact that French women, especially in the peasantry, are included in the business. They talk about money with their husband. They're even sometimes in charge of it. They're super cheap. And, you know, you think of Balzac. That's true. They're uber cheap and very, 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 in French we say économe, you know, someone who puts money away all the time, wants to save.
Frugal.
Frugal, very frugal. And still to this day, French people are amongst of all the industrialized country, people who have the most money saved up, they have a lot of money saved up. They don't spend it. They don't use credit cards. They're very different from Americans in that regard. Americans spend, and then they pay later. French people are not like that.
Your point about credit cards is interesting because I keep on wondering whether this is a larger issue of American culture. And I don't know where this would come from in American culture. Could it come from the fact that we basically have like a massive amount of the most fertile land in the world, the most rich in terms of mineral resources, the most just incredible bounty. And, you know, lots of it was just kind of given away, right? Lots of it's just... It's something that really did shape the character of the country beyond the peculiarities of just how, you know, whether, you know, too many women are trophy wives or whatever. I don't know. I mean, I feel like that is kind of like a really fundamental driving force for why you maybe see this sort of thing in Americans more.
Wharton mentions that, actually. And when she talks about America, she says that it's a land of opportunity. She says Americans don't have to be careful because there's no real threat that they have to prepare themselves for up to now, you know, because that's it's the end of that era in 1919. Now America has entered the world scene and they are now playing with the you know, the big guys, and they will have to sort of protect themselves against them. But she says that French people have been in that situation forever. They had to deal with the Spaniards, they had to deal with the British, with the Germans, with the Italians. They're always in danger to an extent, to a degree. And that's how she explains it. I don't know that it's true, but she says, so French people had this, they're afraid. They have this mentality, we need to be prepared for when the Germans come back, because they will. It's just a question of time. And that's how she sort of gives the genealogy of that very thrifty mentality that French people have, and the same for Americans. They don't have that fear. They have that confidence that whatever happens, they can, you know, they can make money. They can spend it now. There's always money to be made later. No worries. And in America, it's, I don't know if it's still true today, but it was true for most of its existence. So yes, she agrees with you on that point.
So what are we supposed to do about Undines in the world then? I mean, is it sort of too late? I don't know. I mean, this is another thing that I wonder about the novel is, you know, what are you supposed to do about this? I think an idea that's definitively rejected in the novel is what Ralph tries to do, which is to try to improve her. There seems to be no way to improve someone like this.
He thinks that his love, the power of his love, will redeem her. That's true. He's so naive.
This is actually really kind of close to Swan's Way by Marcel Proust. It's basically another story about a guy who, you know, has illusions about a woman who's basically a prostitute, and he doesn't realize that she's a prostitute. He just pays for everything for her. And anyway, I kept on thinking of Swan's Way, which is also one of the things that makes me doubt that there's really anything so different about the French and the Americans, because it seems like the same plot, but just from a different perspective, that this is so close to Swan's Way, roughly at the same time. Both Proust and her were existing in the same bubble of wealth. World War I really kind of brought the economic system at the time to a screeching halt. Right before then was just, just enormous concentrations of wealth and the sort of illusions that come with that kind of wealth. I don't know. I mean, both Ralph and Swan kind of suffer from the same sort of problem. I mean, they are not exposed to reality either, right? Ralph wasn't properly exposed to reality. Like, I'm a lawyer, right? Like, but it used to be a gentleman's profession, right? Mm-hmm. It's not how it is now, where it's kind of much more cutthroat. It was a time when it was like much more like you just kind of showed up and collected your paycheck and whatever, right? At least that's how it's portrayed. So you could say, to the extent that she's coddled, you could say that Ralph is coddled too.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, why isn't Ralph like a better, I mean, maybe a better Ralph could actually change her. I don't know.
There's a passage where Wharton says exactly what you just said. It's page 46, where she basically tells us that he's asked by his family to live, quote unquote, like a gentleman. So he's a dilettante. Can we say that? He's a dilettante. Mm-hmm. Like, he likes to do a little bit of this, a little bit of that. He's not good in anything. He plays a little bit of violin. He writes a little bit of poetry. He can paint a little bit, but not too much. And his family is okay with that. It's fine.
But he's serving the perceptions of others, like Houdin, where he's saying, of course they're going to think I'm something special because they think I'm a poet. They think that I'm a musician, a violinist.
Well,
it's all about the perception of what he is.
Yes, they do care about the perception of others. You're correct. They do. There are certain things that he's not allowed to do or to say because of what others might think. It's not behaving like a gentleman. That's what he has to do. He is too the product of the custom of the country, just a different custom. The family that he comes from is a burden to him. And later in the novel, he's described as a modern man in medieval armor. He's sort of sitting between two chairs. He has this tradition, very traditional, dignified, gentlemanly code of honor that he has to abide by. You know, divorce is not even a word that is allowed to be pronounced. There are certain things that do not exist, even if they do. And if you see them, you have to pretend that you didn't see them. But he lives in a world that has become modern. And he lives exactly during that time where that modernity is has become so dominant that it can no longer be ignored. And so he has to join that modern world, and he's not equipped to deal with it. You know, he can't fight against Elmer Muffet or Donald Trump. They have no principle. They will crush him. And they do. You know, he's just ridiculous compared to them. Because there are certain things he won't do. Or he will do too late because he, you know, hesitated because it was not moral. And he's a very pathetic, not in a mean way, pathetic, sad figure.
But that's because he's right part of a, quote, dying breed, right? Yeah. He always refers to himself as like the Aboriginal tribe, right?
The invader
species, right, coming in. And like, what are their guiding principles, right? They have, you know, his set have guiding principles that are based on, like, you know, years and years and years of tradition, right? And, you know, everyone else's principles are based on, you know, the dollar, you know, like money and just gains, right? Just how to navigate between these worlds, right? Because they're no longer like immune to the pressures of, you know, these people who are, you know, capitalists, Wall Street people, that sort of thing. I think that was really interesting, you know, that she tries to also provide like a counterpoint in France because they have a huge, I mean, I think that's one of the biggest things, right? Like when we're talking about the difference between, you know, America and other maybe like older European nations, right? That they do have a tradition of like nobility, you know, aristocracy, like, you know, these types of hierarchies. And, you know, in America was, you know, like there wasn't not any hierarchy, but, you know, it was a little bit more, you know, equitable, like, you know, for different peoples of, you know, different starting ranks, I guess. And, you know, the different societies permit like different levels of whatever new money capitalism to kind of infiltrate their ranks. Right.
But that's a very interesting parallel because even in France, Elmer Muffet ends up winning. He buys those tapestries. They have they have to sell it to them because he has too much money. And even that's actually a very cynical way to end her novel. When there's enough money on the table, even French aristocrats sell their heirlooms. They have they're victims of Wall Street. They will greed. Pass too. I'm sorry?
The greed again. To hinder back to the...
I don't think it's greed, actually. Sometimes, you know, Wharton has a lot of characters who are just like, you know, I have so much money, I don't even know what to spend it on, right? And then they just go around and look for, like, random things to spend it on that totally, like, destroy other people's lives or, like, modes of living, and they don't think about it.
Elmer Muffet is a conqueror. He doesn't... He's... At one point, I was sort of puzzled because he's described... Wharton tells us that he has sort of developed an interest for art, you know. He has all these little works of art, and he's looking at them. And I was like thinking, what is happening to him? Is he becoming someone interesting? No, no, no. That's money for him. That, and at the end, we learn that the real reason why he's after these paintings and he wants to see these private collections and he's interested in purchasing that sculpture or that other bibelot or whatever is money. He knows that the market for that those kinds of things is crazy. So he doesn't accumulate money to be able to spend it. He's not a spender. He's someone who just wants to make more money to be the number one and stay the number one. That's what he's interested in.
Money is a scoreboard.
Yeah, it's a scoreboard. And right now he's number one.
And it's the same thing with her, with Undine and her attitude towards society, right? And popularity, right? Like it's the object of life is to maximize the regard of others. And what is that regard exactly? It's not really any sort of genuine appreciation. It's sort of like just like an awe. Undine wants to be someone who, when you walk in the room, it's like, oh, it's Undine. It's just such a weird way of going about the world. Undine wants the regard of others, but she doesn't really want love. She doesn't really want a lover, which is why she isn't content to just carry on an affair under the nose of her husband. And the reason why an affair isn't good enough isn't because she thinks an affair would be wrong. It's because having an affair wouldn't further her project of improving her social standing. There's a funny comment to this effect made by a friend of Undine, who's also from Apex and has the same mentality. This friend says that having a secret love affair while married is like being, quote, the women in those nasty French plays. And that's a quote from page 213. It's actually something, there's so much cheating in this. You kind of wonder, well, can't you just do the French thing and have a lover or something? Or
I think in other Wharton novels, right, that is how like the New York society, like aristocrats did do it, right? They just like had all these like weird side affairs and it was just like a, you know, musical chairs of like who was hanging out with who, you know, and they would just like pass wives and whatever around. But now people can get officially divorced. And how does that actually change, you know, like the social structure or like hierarchy?
Something that you said, Danielle, made me think of a note that I took on page 216. Wharton writes, talking about Undine, the pleasures for which her sex took such risks, sexual pleasures, had never attracted her. She doesn't care about sex. That's not what she doesn't want a lover. She couldn't care less about that. What she was after, and it's the same passage, what she was after, and in that sense, she's not an immoral woman, because Undine doesn't believe that she's immoral. She understands by immorality having sex with someone else than your husband. She doesn't care about that. No. What she wants are amusement and respectability. She wants to have fun and she wants to be admired. That's it. Sex? Because amusement does not include sex for her. Amusement is just being in a very, very luxurious room and being at the center of attention of everybody and laughing and having these shallow, gossipy conversations. Nothing too serious because then she's not very good at it. But, you know, as long as it remains superficial and we talk about people, not things, and that's mentioned several times, then she's the best.
Yes, I wonder how long you can keep something like this up, right? Because it's so transitory, right? All of her highs. And she always, right, Wharton is always saying that she knows what she wants and she can, like, see herself getting it, but she can never really, right, like, envision, like, the monotonous times in between of, you know, of regular everyday life. And she keeps jumping. Like, and this is the one thing that Fabrice, you were saying before, I think, right? Like, does she even know herself, right? Because she, you know, goes after things kind of like, not in good faith, but not in malice either. But she doesn't know that it's not going to be a lasting reward for her, right? You know, soon, like, the high will wear off and then she will just be on to the next thing.
And she does not realize that she's always doing that. Wait a minute. Am I doing the same thing that I've done with my first three husbands?
Yeah.
Could the problem be me? No.
I mean, this place takes place in only like 10 years. And so I think it's crazy. I mean, like, how long can she keep this up for?
As long as she's beautiful. Now, her downfall, which will happen, is when she loses her beauty. Because we're told right at the beginning that she was an extremely beautiful woman. Like, not just pretty. She was stunningly beautiful. The way that Wharton says it, I think it's page 13 or 14. I noted it because it's page 14. So right at the beginning of the novel, she writes, "But Undine's beauty was as vivid and almost as crude as the brightness suffusing it. Her black brows, her reddish tawny hair, and the pure red and white of her complexion defied the searching, decomposing radiance. She might have been some fabled creature whose home was in a beam of light."
Yeah, her appearance is always linked with like the glowing electric lights, which I think were probably new in the city, but like very symbolic of Undine, right? Something really flashy, really showy, something that would grab your attention and like fixate people's attention this whole time. So I thought she was definitely like making a comment also, you know, about these like newer technologies, you know, the newer money, everything coming in.
Probably. But she's... When you see Undine, you've never seen someone prettier than her in your life. Like, she's someone that you do not forget when you've seen her. I mean, for very superficial reasons, but she has that. That's one of her main assets, but it's an asset that you end up losing, as we all know.
That's really interesting. It would be really interesting to see, like, Undine in 20 years, like, what happened to her.
It's like all these celebrities who, when they hit 50 or 55 or 60, and then you see them having these, you know, procedures done to remove this, uplift that, and they just become uglier and uglier, and it's kind of sad to see them. They just don't want to, they can't give up. They can't just let go, because their whole life is based on that. They have nothing else.
It's the source of their power, right?
Yeah. And behind that power, there's nothing. If they lose it, they lose everything. I'm not going to name any names. A few come to mind.
Nina, how does this compare to like Age of Innocence and House of Mirth?
Yeah, so I mean, I just thought it was very different. I mean, the writing is like kind of the same, but basically for the Age of Innocence, which I think would be more like this one than House of Mirth, it's sort of like from a Ralph point of view, mostly. And, you know, he's fallen in love with an ex-divorcee who is the cousin of his fiancée. And it's basically a decision about, like, should he break off the wedding to, like, the girl he's supposed to promise, and, like, that everybody, like, all of society is, like, they're getting married, and this is, like, how it goes. This is how the, you know, the world works, right? Their families, right? Or can he, like, cut and run out of society, right? Or, you know, how much of a hold does society have on the individual players in it, right? He's just, and then, like, over the course of the book, he realizes he's just, you know, like, a player in this machine, like this game, not a game, I don't know how you can say, but like maybe like a play, right? He's just like one of the characters, and he just has to follow the script. He's just supposed to follow the script. You're not supposed to deviate from the script. And, you know, in the end, like him and the divorcee, even though they really love each other, decide not to get married and not to try, like, cause a fuss, you know, and sacrifice themselves to, you know, like the harmony of the society. And so I thought that this one is kind of talking about the same types of people, right? Because, you know, that the Marvels really represent this whole, like, traditional society that, you know, everyone is just like a character in this society. And, you know, you just have all these established traditions, all these, you know, like things that you're supposed to do, say, who you're supposed to marry, who you're supposed to associate with. And, you know, can you really break out of it? And so I think this is interesting because Ralph actually does take a chance on an outsider, but it's disastrous, you know? And so, you know, I think maybe for Age of Innocence, she decided that he, you know, like this male protagonist would not take the chance on the outsider, even though he was so tempted, you know? And then in the end, you know, like his life just goes exactly like everyone else's life goes, you know? You know, marry, have kids.
So a wiser Ralph.
It's like a wiser Ralph, yeah.
Because let's face it, Ralph's life would probably have been happier.
Yeah.
If he had not met Undine that evening at that dinner where he saw
absolutely
her. That was not a good thing for him.
But yeah, like the, this is the protagonist in the, or like the Newland Archer of Age of Innocence, right? He's also a lawyer. And, you know, they do make fun of like his gentleman's job where he like goes in for 2 hours in the morning and then has like a 2 hour lunch. And then he like goes in for like two more hours and like signs some papers and then he like leaves, you know, it's like a sinecure, right? You know, you don't really do anything. You just like say you do something and then you go out and then you go to your gentleman's club like afterwards, right? Or whatever. And so.
It's like Phileas Fogg in Around the World in 80 Days. Never works, always has a lot of money. He goes to his club with his friends and just reads the newspaper for 4 hours. That's his job. And then goes to play whist for 2 hours and then has another dinner. And we'll see each other tomorrow,
really
gentlemen.
So it's just really interesting. I think Wharton gets a lot of flack for writing about like the problems of society and people like, oh, you know, aristocrats can't have problems. I mean, like, they have so much money. They're so babied, right? Uh-huh. But you can see actually they have a lot of problems because they kind of like don't have anything to like do with their time. And that also kind of, I think, messes with people in a different way, you know? And then they get, you know, all bogged down in all of these small little like, you know, customs, you know, and things like that. And this whole thing about, you know, social circles, who are included, what types of people are included, what type of people are excluded, right? Like, you know, who's shunned and who's, you know, welcomed with open arms. And, you know, I guess this sort of thing can, you know, take a toll on people, but like more psychologically than maybe like a physical labor type
that
of
is,
issue.
That's so true. Me, the thing that I think would have hurt me the most or would have displeased me the most is the silence. You know, there are certain things we can't talk about. So Ralph is heartbroken. Nobody says anything. Like, they will allude to his sadness, but nobody will just grab him by the shoulder and say, it sucks that she dumped you. She was not a good person. You're better off without her. Nobody has that frankness.
Yeah, not even his sister or his like mom, right? They kind of like secretly tiptoe and kind of like help him out in nonverbal ways, right? But it's like totally taboo to talk about. And he doesn't even like, he's sort of like too reticent to talk to Claire, who I think would be able to like level with him like one-on-one, right? She knows him in and out, but like because social propriety dictates, right, that they should not be meeting or whatever, you know, he just keeps his distance, you know, at the expense of his like mental sanity, you know?
And Nina, that's an angle, you see, that we didn't explore. He kills himself because he's alone. He has this family, and that's kind of a paradoxical conclusion because you could think, no, they have this huge structure, you know, they stay together. Individualism is, you know, the characteristic of modernity. They're not like that, but he's alone. He is alone to deal with his huge problem and with his very, very difficult situation, and he can't do it, and they will not, they can't help him because he's become toxic in a way. He's become an untouchable.
Yeah, it's pretty quite modern because it's sort of like a death of despair, right? That's what people kind of talk about these days, right? People feeling really isolated, you know, even if they're actually surrounded by loads of people, right? But if you can't actually express yourself, I mean, it's still isolation. It's actually even worse because you got to pretend that you're like a normal functioning human when inside, you know, you're like dying.
Actually, I was surprised that there was no movie ever made
from
the book. And so I went, I Googled it, and Sofia Coppola has bought the rights or something like, I don't know if she bought the rights, but she is working on a TV series or a series, Netflix series or HBO series. I don't know which one. I don't know if it's still a project, but in 2018, it was. She loves that book.
I do sense that there is more attention to the novel more recently for whatever reason. When growing up, reading books, I have never heard of this book. No one ever talked about this book. But looking into it, I very quickly discovered that this book has a following, and I do think it is like a 21st century phenomenon.
It's really relevant today, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, it can be a hard thing in a novel to have your protagonist be a complete kind of sociopath or not. Sociopath is kind of psychologizing it too much, but just someone who seems very much involved in themselves. Like, you know, typically protagonists are kind of like believe in bigger things. Maybe they have flaws or whatever, but they believe in marriage or they believe in the country or something, you know? And it's just, it's an uncommon thing in a novel to have someone who's so kind of self-directed or someone who's so self-involved be the protagonist. And, you know, I have to admit, like, it did, I did wonder, like, what the value of it was, sort of. There is, it's fascinating, but I just, like, when I look at this compared to, say, I don't know, Great Gatsby or something. But then again, Gatsby is, he's a man on a quest for a woman, right? As a, like becoming a muckety-muck in society is sort of like a necessary step to his larger goal. And his larger goal has a certain amount of pathos and sympathy to it, you know? Whereas this, it's just an end in itself. So go on.
That's why I thought this was a really great compliment if you read other Wharton books, because sometimes, you know, the person who's like thrown into the mix that kind of like rattles the whole society, you wonder like, what is their viewpoint, right? Or just like, yeah, like, I don't know. I read old books, right? So I think, you know, like in Middlemarch, right, there is like a character, Rosamund Vinci, who's always thinking about herself, right? And she doesn't really care what happens to her husband. She's like trying to spend money behind his back and like whatever, right? And you always think like, what is going through this person's head that she doesn't really care what the effects of her actions are on other people? And so I just thought this was like a really great, like you always, it's not, okay, I don't want to say it's not valuable, but what I'm saying is like, it's not saying anything in itself, but like if you put it, juxtapose it with, you know, her other Wharton's other novels, it kind of explains, the other side of the coin. So you get like a fuller picture of both ways. Like, how do these outsiders feel that, you know, the you know, like established elite are treating them, and how silly do their customs look, or, you know, how empty are they, right? How easily are they destroyed?
If you were to make Undine a hero in some sort of feminist reappropriation of this, if you wanted to do that, the way you do it is you play up all these frailties of the existing system of this old New York, of the old aristocracy. You know, literally it needs someone to come over and just push it over. You know, this is like...
That's a good point.
This is an argument that people, you know, will make for Trump or something. Like, you know, whatever you want to say about him... You know, he's the guy who came in here.
At least he's genuine. Yeah.
Yeah, and showed it was all bullshit or something. You know what I mean? Like, I don't buy into that necessarily, but like, this would be the rehabilitation of Undine if you wanted to make her, if you want to portray her positively. I think that maybe was Sophia Copeland's problem is like, how do you, I think it would, even for Netflix, right, or whoever, like, it would just be a difficult thing to come in and be like, yeah, we're going to make a show about a sociopath and she wins, right?
No, but then I can tell you right now how it's going to happen, what's going to happen. She's going to rewrite the book and make of Undine this, you know, very courageous woman who has to live in a world where only men decide everything and she has to fight against them to get what she wants, and what she wants is respectability. She's going to do that.
Well, maybe.
I read an interview of her and she sees that she's that feminist hero, you know, who had to fight to defend herself and her ideas and what she wanted against people who did not want to give it to her because she's a woman.
I the female Trump is the real angle here.
We should send her the podcast. We should send Sophia Coppola the podcast just to help her. She doesn't want. She won't want to listen to it. I wanted to if we still have a little bit of time. I in 1934, Edith Wharton wrote a backward glance. It's her memoirs, and she tells of a conversation that she had with Henry James. Apparently, he was her friend, and they talk about the custom of the country once, and she remembers the conversation. I just thought I'd read it because it's interesting. Where is it? Okay, it's there. Another day, somewhat later in our friendship being Edith Wharton's and Henry James's friendship, since this time the work under his scalpel was the custom of the country. After prolonged and really generous praise of my book, he suddenly and irrepressibly burst forth. But of course, you know, as how should you, with your infernal keenness of perception, not know that in doing your tale you had under your hand a magnificent subject which ought to have been your main theme, and that you used it as a mere incident and then passed it by. He meant by this that for him, the chief interest of the book and its most original theme was that of a crude young woman such as Undine Sprague entering, all unprepared and unperceiving, into the mysterious labyrinth of family life in the old French aristocracy. I saw his point and recognized that the contact between Undine Sprague and the French families they marry into, as the French themselves would say, an actuality of immense interest to the novelist of manners, and one which, as yet, had been little dealt with. But I argued that in the custom of the country, I was chronicling the career of a particular young woman, and that, to whatever hemisphere her fortunes carried her, my task was to record her ravages and pass on to her next phase. I think that pretty much sums it all very well. The chronicle of Undine's ravages. That's what the book is.
That's the name of the mini series, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Undine's ravages.
Give me she's a wrecking ball. Subtitle.
She destroys everything around her.
This is a really weirdly deterministic picture of humanity. That's the other thing that weirdly rubbed me the wrong way about this whole thing. It's almost like Hobbesian.
So I think that Wharton's books are kind of like this. It's like really there's no free will kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like this is the way the world works, and this is, you know, the conveyor belts of everyone going on it, and you can't.
That's a very good point, actually. There's no redemption.
And that ties in with the point that was made earlier as to the explanation of why she is like she is, where like genetic determinism, like it's her dad, right? Like, and it just makes me wonder. And the pioneer spirit, it's not just the spirit. It's like we're us Americans. We're like, you know, like a little subspecies or something, right? Like we're these weird, psychotic people who decided to leave their families and, you know, come here and, you know, tough it out or whatever, right? Like, I kind of wonder how much of that is actually her vision of humanity. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much it's wrong. It's hard to say how much it's wrong, right? But it's, you know, I think that is kind of the underlying framework of how she looks at people.
Sadly.
Yeah.
I think that it's most of the time there's no redemption. We are who we are. And like it or not, we kind of, it's very hard to escape from what we are. And especially as we grow older, it becomes harder and harder. Making the same mistakes, making the same decisions, and suffering the consequences. There are impulses in us that are very, very, very hard to battle against. I don't want to say that we're not free. We have a certain degree of freedom, but we also have a personality, and Undine's personality certainly is very well defined from a very young age. Maybe it is true. Maybe we are like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think basically most of Wharton's books are sort of like, if you try and escape the system, like something terrible will happen to you. There's a lot of that, you know, innate qualities, right, that really just predetermine, you know, kind of like your life trajectory. I do think that there is a little bit to say about society, like the society that you are in that does govern, like the extent to which, you know, there is some flexibility. But she was writing kind of at a time where I think like at least this sort of stuff was like pretty static. So it was really hard to actually escape. You know, it wasn't so like global yet where you could kind of really go somewhere else, right? Because like here, you know, Undine's like fleeing to Paris, but like really she sees the same people in Paris, you know? Or like the Americans are infiltrating there anyway, right? So she can never really like escape her past and her reputation and that kind of thing. Maybe like in today's world, it may be like slightly different. But I think for like the set she was writing about, you know, it really seemed like, you know, a box you couldn't really escape.